back to the drawing board. That's what we do in September. Going back to school, getting back into a routine, getting back to kind of, if you will, first things. Not that we haven't been this territory before, but it's important to return, to start, to begin. In beginning, we get stretched. I appreciated the stretching that our sister is going through. She's worship leader not just this Sunday, she's going to be worship leader again this month. She's hearing a call from God, nervous about it at times. And I noticed that after you got that right, she was wondering, how do you pronounce Caesarea Philippi? Well, she didn't say that. You notice she paused after that? It was like, yes, I got it. I nailed it. Back to the drawing board. The story from the Gospel of Mark is kind of a pivotal one in this particular gospel. In fact, you could sort of divide this gospel in half with this story. This story sort of marks the pinnacle of the first part. The first part sort of is aiming upward up until this story, and then it takes a shift as matters turn towards Jerusalem and the things that lay ahead for Jesus and his disciples. You could say that, in fact, this story is sort of a returning to the drawing board kind of story. For here, Jesus is asking that question that we all need to answer. Exactly who is this Jesus? Who is Jesus to you? There are many different answers to that question, are there not? I mean, as we think about it, we could come up with all sorts. You know, Jesus, okay, we say Savior, Friend, Lord, Messiah. We've got a whole list of things we could say. But there's a lot of other things. I was on the internet last night kind of looking, and they actually have some videos where they've gone out and just into the streets and asking people. And some of their responses are very interesting. He's a good guy. Don't know much about him. Or I'm not sure if he really existed. Answers like that. And we're honest. Jesus asked his disciples, okay, out on the roads, on the highways, as you've been going about among people, what have you heard? Now, is this an example of polling? Taking a poll? I mean, some leaders operate by polls, you know. They wait to see what other people are saying, and then they kind of flow with the wind where it seems to be blowing. I don't think that Jesus was taking a poll. Okay, who do people say that I am? And so that, you know, the majority, if the most of them are saying this particular thing, that's what I'll be. No. It's not what it was about. It was interesting, some of the answers. Some were saying Elijah. Some were saying John the Baptist. Now, that was a strange one, because I thought people had experienced him those two guys side by side. How could they be the same person? I don't know. Then Jesus shifted the question to ask of the disciples, okay, that's what you've heard. Now, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And here's Peter. Peter in the Gospels, who sometimes gets things right and sometimes gets things wrong. That's why I like Peter so well. He says, Jesus, I got the answer. You are the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the anointed one. Yes. And you can almost imagine him turning to his colleagues, you know, and going, high five, and poof, yes. You nailed it. Got that question right. Only I'm not sure that was really a question that had just one answer. I mean, I've heard plenty of sermons that, and perhaps I've even preached them, that, you know, that Peter got the question right. He got the right answer. So therefore, he gets several stars. But I don't think that was what Jesus was getting at. Yeah, that was one of the answers. But I don't think that was the only answer there was to that question. Because I don't think that the question of faith has but one answer. We sometimes phrase it that way. You know, that if only you say the right thing, you give the right answer, then everything's going to be okay. You know, if you only say this, then that shows that you are a person of faith. But faith is not about the words that we speak so much as it is about the trust that we have that goes beyond the words that we say. Because we may even get the words right, but we haven't a clue as to what they'll mean. I mean, that could have been the question that Jesus would have asked, could have asked. And I wish Jesus had asked of Peter. And perhaps by what he says next, he is kind of asking the question. I mean, here is Peter saying, "You are the Christ." Yes! And Jesus saying, "Okay, now what does that mean?" Jesus went on to talk about what it means. That there is suffering down the road ahead. There's darkness. There's struggle. There's trouble. And the Son of Man is going to be delivered up. And that delivered up isn't necessarily a really highfalutin, good old-fashioned but wonderful experience. It's going to involve a cross. And you've got this strange twist of events. Now, Matthew's recollection of this moment inserts something about Peter upon his confession being given by Jesus the keys and being told that upon this rock, you are the rock, and upon this rock, I will build my church. Mark's gospel kind of doesn't have that. Instead, it shifts very quickly into Jesus talking about suffering and instructs Peter, in fact, not even to say to others what he has just spoken. And as soon as Jesus utters those words, Peter rebukes him. Because he hasn't really understood what Messiah anointing, what Christ stuff is all about. I mean, in the back of his mind, he's thinking that it's going to involve all the highfalutin things that come with being anointed. I mean, after all, kings were anointed and they put on their crowns and they entered into the palace and the capital with accolades, riding on a white horse, and they led their armies into battle and were victorious. And I don't know what Peter was really thinking, but it says that he rebuked Jesus for saying these words. He told Jesus, "I think you need to cut that out. Now that's not part of the picture. Shh." And Jesus says to him some of the harshest words that we find in the gospel. I mean, he didn't call the scribes and Pharisees a Satan. He called them hypocrites. He called them blind guides, fools. But did he call them Satan? And here's Peter, and he says, "Get behind me, Satan. For your mind is not set on the things of God. Your mind's set on the different place. I don't know where your mind's at, but it ain't where it should be." And then he talks not so much about his own path as he talks about the path of becoming a disciple. And this is sort of getting back to the drawing board. You know, that if you think that gaining your life is a process of grabbing, then you've got it all wrong. It's a releasing that moves in the direction of God. There's crosses. There are things to bear in the road that can't be avoided, nor should they, because they're what lead to strength. It's the way of the cross that leads to the empty tomb, does it not? That's what our faith tells us. Getting back to the drawing board. I thought about this. I had to think about a book that I'm currently reading by Kathleen Norris. And it's entitled Acedia and Me. And she is actually examining one of the seven deadly sins that's called acedia. We call it by a different name today. It became something different later on. But originally, the seven deadly sins were not called seven deadly sins. They actually, that whole concept started in the monastery movement, the movement of asceticism, the drawing closer to God movement out in the desert movement, the desert father movement, and such persons as Saint Benedict, who wrote his rule of life, you know, for a monk or what, you know, later a nun or whatever. And these did not begin as seven deadly sins. They were seven deadly thoughts. Ways of thinking that will lead you down a path that you don't want to go. Now, calling it thoughts rather than sins takes a little bit of the whatever off this. But the acedia became, in our understanding of it today, what we would call the sin of, oh shoot, all of a sudden it's left my mind. Help. The sin of, no. Oh gosh, you've never had one of these blocks before. I can't think of the word. Think of some of the deadly seven deadly sins. There's lust, there's gluttony, there is sloth. Sloth. It became the sin of sloth. But today, as we think of that particular sin, we have shifted it to be kind of laziness, but sloth and acedia is not so much about doing nothing. See, there are a lot of people today who are very, very busy, but they're pulled down by sloth. What sloth, what acedia is all about, and why it is so deadly in our lives is it because it gives us a sense of losing our purpose. We don't know why we do what we do. What difference does it make is the question that is asked in acedia. And there's that, why it would be so deadly for somebody in a monastery who is leading a very ascetic life is, why am I doing this? Why continue? Which is a question I think we all face, not just those of us in the monastery. Why? What difference does it make? What good will it do? Many of us are so busy at our lives and we don't know what on earth we're doing, where we are going. We don't have a sense of having that sense of calling and purpose, you know, from God. Anyways, to get at this, I was thinking about how Benedict's rule of living kind of ends. It has all these rules. And that's, I guess, what you think of with a monastery, living a life and commandments. But it ends by saying that all of this is just a beginning. All of this is just a beginning. Can we get that sense that every day for us is a beginning? Every day is a beginning. And that is actually a freeing thing. You know, as I think about Noack and the people who go to Noack, and I think about my elders who I have come to, the ones who I've really come to listen to, the ones that really make a difference on my life are the ones who admit that they are still learners. They haven't got it all together. And that as they grow, they still are having more and more questions. They're just beginners. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing for a teacher to admit. A teacher who walks into a classroom believing or even saying that he or she's got it all together. I know it and I'm going to impart it to you so that you may have it. Isn't going to get anywhere with students, are they? But the ones who see themselves as learners as well and who are beginning on this path as well, those are the ones who are successful. Because if we're all beginners, it's good to have somebody beside us, yes, who's been down that path, but, and I'm not calling for us to just throw away what's gone before us, but to come to a sense that we are beginning. One of the most frustrating things for me as a pastor is the losses over the years of that freedom that came with being somebody new to ministry. There's a freedom there because you don't know all the answers yet. And people give you a pass. They do. When you're younger, they say, oh, he's still learning. And there's something freeing about that. The older you get, well, you should know better. But the truth is, we're still, all of us, learning. All of us are students, each and every one of us. We never arrive. So it's not about the end, it's about the getting there. And I think getting back to this story from the Gospel of Mark and is that it's really at the pinnacle of the story, but it's pivotal. It marks a pivotal point in the journey of faith. Where a disciple who thought he had the answer was shown that he was still very much at the beginning of the path. And I believe that was a lesson for the years ahead when he would become a key leader in the church. For as great as Peter had become, he was still always but a beginner.